big dust from the National Credit Act, the National Credit Regulator. And we do have the National Credit Regulator with us this morning. It may be pertinent for us to just get an update on their work. Would you agree with that, just for 3 minutes or so? Right, okay. So we're going to do that before we have the presentation by Summit Finance. On that note, please can we have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda? Yes, Honourable Bayani, seconded by the Honourable Kachalia. Apologies. Mr. Hermans?
Chair, we have the standing apology from Mr. McPherson on party business. Ms. von Skalkwyk and Ms. Tech, who is attending the Labour Committee. Ms. Shangwini is on medical leave.
Can I just check? Labour is not at our program, is it? Is it an 8-hour program? No.
No.
So they will just point out to them or get them a Seabrook to go down to Labour and tell them they'll be back when Labour is completed and not in the village. Thank you.
And Ms. Advocate Alberts will be joining us this morning. He's just on the evening. He will come.
Mr. Hermans, right. I did just alert you then to, and I alerted the National Credit Regulator, Ms. Machigari, but before I ask you just to speak to the issue, I should note that the most senior person here with us today is the acting Director General, you know, Deputy Director General, Mr. Nyetsi Tensi, thank you. All right. Having said that, please can you take the floor, Ms. Machigari.
Good morning, honourable members, the acting DDG and the officials from the DTI. Regarding the matter surrounding Capitec, we did a compliance check last year, and in terms of the information that we have available, we did not identify any reckless loans. I think that's all we can say for now. We are still, you know, looking into the matter. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. Are there any comments from the members in that regard? There appears to be confidence in what you are doing, so if you will keep us briefed if anything emerges that we should know about immediately. Thank you. So on that particular note then, we're going to begin with the presentation by Summit Finance. We've got the presenter here, the Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Clark Gardner, his team, Ms. Kraser, Ms. van der Merwe, legal manager, one's a legal advisor, and then Ms. Elsa Retta Carstens, attorney. Where's the attorney? Right, let's always note these things, you see. And Ms. Alette Gariki? Ah, over there. So it's only the one person that's not with us today. Right. So do go ahead then, Mr. Gardner.
Is that better? Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd love you to extend the questions and comments regarding Capitec to myself. If we find any time, I've got perhaps half an hour of comments and questions thereafter. So please consider that thereafter. to start off with, I suppose it's again with great disappointment that Summit sits here, feeling that we were here on a number of occasions and have submitted a number of submissions for bills and amendments, and never have we been heard. despite, I suppose, us being the only true voice of the consumer, especially the body that actually takes these fights in court and makes use of the National Credit Act in court and gets to really feel its pitfalls and complications and ambiguity, as a result of not being heard, perhaps, in previous submissions. So where, from where we sit, it's important to emphasize that Summit really gets to experience the suffering of those consumers who are over-indebted. And currently we sit with 50% of credit active consumers who've missed an installment, so they're in arrears. That's 10 million people. That's a lot of consumers. And of that group, there's a vast majority that is experiencing great harm and great suffering. We get to see the mine workers whose debt installments exceed 70% of their income. And it is done so lawfully because of our submissions regarding the minimum expense tables being unheard. And trust me, we fight that in court and we get to see the complications that arise from our submissions being unheard. We also understand how unsecured lending has trapped and disempowered, financially disempowered, these consumers. And the way we see it, it equates to economic apartheid. They are in a debt spiral. There's a group that you referred to as earning less than 7,500 Rand per month in net in income. They attracted 0.21% of mortgage bonds in the last quarter reported. That's because they're financially disempowered. They can't access good credit, credit that creates wealth, because they're in a spiral. They're in a debt spiral on debt that's attracting yields of 300-400% per annum. You're going to ask me, how does it attract such yields? Well, if you look at the initiation fee on a payday loan, it's 12%. 10 days of 1,000 Rand on the initiation fee, that's 12% per month. And you can times that by 12. That's already where you get your numbers from. So this is high-yielding, high-costing debt that is disempowering a vast majority of our credit active consumers and really taking away any access to justice with our submissions being unheard. The reason I say that, go look at our court cases. Tobajani is a case from an Anglo Platinum mine worker, and Tobajani has cost us, we're challenging reckless lending, it has cost us to date just under R1 million to fight reckless lending in the High Court of the Western Cape. It's taken us well over 2 years, and our case has still not been heard. Now, when you're fighting reckless lending, it's very important to emphasize, and it is important in the fact when you're talking about debt intervention, that consumer can't put food on the table that day. They can't wait 6 months, 12 months, 2 years for a resolution or a solution. They need debt relief that day. And when we look at a Tobajani case who can't put food on the table for that month, and we compare it to the seven banks that you're going to hear after me, or seven lenders that you're going to hear after me with deep pockets, we've got advisors that trick and trap you to authorizing minimum expense tables. They are earning 20% return on equity. They're okay. The system is okay. They're earning billions of rands in profits, and Tobajani can't put food on their table. So somehow our submissions have to get greater weighting than the seven lenders with deep pockets and great advisors that are going to submit after us and be able to, again, trick you and trap you into laws that I cannot enforce. And I emphasize we are one of the very few that are actually trying to enforce this law in the court of law. We bring you back to the introduction of the National Credit Act, where its purpose states to promote a fair, transparent, responsible market and provide protection for consumers. We have failed in that. You have failed in that. There are 10 million consumers in arrears, of which the vast majority has impaired records. They are financially disempowered. A lot of the power in the bill is vested on the NCR to submit your debt intervention and reckless lending to give them more power. Now, we've experienced many submissions and many complaints at the National Credit Regulator, including a few thousand for Capitec, against Capitec, one on reckless lending, which was referred to the National Credit Tribunal, and then somehow where there's no recourse in law for this, the law doesn't allow for it, but it was unreferred from the National Consumer Tribunal. I'd love to know how the hell does that happen? How do you unrefer a matter referred to the National Consumer Tribunal?
Mr. Gardner, if I may interrupt you.
Sure.
With a statement like that, it's very constructive if we can get when and what was the company, so that we can then drill down as a committee.
Oh, gladly. It was a complaint on the Capitec multi-loan. It was December 2016 is going to be my best guess. I'll provide all the details. It was referred to the National Credit Regulator. We didn't get a chance to join, although we were the complainant. In the unreferred from the National Consumer with, Tribunal, the withdrawal, we were not provided any reasons. We were not provided any substantive information. And as a result, as the complainant, we never fully empowered and never enlightened. This includes the Capfin settlement, which is referred in the sign-off Viceroy report. We never got sight of settlement, although those were our complaints with those consumers. So we really do feel you know, left out in terms of as a complainant. Further, what's important, if you refer, and I emphasize, if you refer a reckless lending case or a debt intervention case to the National Credit Regulator, which is what this bill is advising, that consumer, and I emphasize again, requires debt or relief that month. They can't put food on the table that month. It needs to be immediate. It's a cash flow issue. It is not a balance sheet issue. They need that cash flow that month. But to give an example of the length of time that a complaint or submission to the National Credit Regulator takes, we refer to our Lewis complaint in terms of their compulsory delivery fee. The complaint started in January 2015. We submitted our first complaint on the compulsory nature of the Lewis delivery fee. What that means, the delivery fee, is that if you buy a cell phone, they compel you to, if you buy it on credit and you're a first-time credit consumer, you are compelled to pay a delivery fee. Whether you walk out with that cell phone or get it delivered to your house is irrelevant. And they charge you 850 Rand. Now, the majority of those consumers are grant recipients and low-income earners earning around 3,500 per month. So their financial ignorance is high and they don't understand that, but there is a desperation to get that cell phone or laptop or piece of furniture. We added to this complaint in September 2016 with more detailed analysis, including an affidavit by the Lewis directors that they do charge compulsory delivery fees on first-time credit customers. In September 2017, the investigation was finalized. Jacqueline Peters, head of NCR's investigation, informed us that it is finalized in writing. It took them another 2 months and a letter of demand by our attorneys before they gave us a notice of non-referral. So that includes 34 months we had to wait to get a notice of non-referral. Now only can I go to court. That will take me another 3 years. So it takes me 6 years to resolve the fact that Lewis is stealing via this compulsory nature of delivery fees for consumers that buy a laptop or a cell phone, even a piece of furniture that does get delivered, they charge 850 Rand to their credit arrangement. 34 months will be too long to resolve debt intervention cases. 34 months will be too long for any reckless lending challenge, and again, consumers will lose faith and stop or not make use of the NCR. I also challenge the members, how does one access the National Credit Regulator when you're earning 1,000 Rand a month via the child grants, SASSA child grants? How do they access this? How is that possible? They don't have time to hold 30 minutes on a phone. They don't have phones. They don't even have reception. I challenge you to try to tell us, how do they access the NCR in order to get relief via this debt intervention proposed bill? Further, I suppose, information regarding the role of the NCR in debt intervention, we've provided them with 159 reckless credit complaints. We've had 62 responses received. The average response time is 5 months. We've had zero tribunal referrals, zero compliance notices sent. So there's a failure to provide consumers with access to justice. And now everything is pointing towards using the National Credit Regulator for debt intervention. Further, if you start reading the debt intervention proposed law, it is filled with holes that deep-pocketed lenders will tuck into. There was dishonest. They lied about their groceries. There was a mistake on their credit report. They could access debt counseling. All these are holes that will prolong the relief, and it will take more than 5 months before that consumer obtains relief. That is not the intention of this bill. That is not the intention of debt intervention or how to protect them from reckless lending. I'll now hand over to my colleague, Marissa Kreuzer.
Thank you for the opportunity just to speak up about the proposed amendments to the National Careers Act contained in the amendment bill. And just to quickly reiterate what was already mentioned regarding the NCR's role in debt intervention, and the slide referring to 62 responses received from the NCR regarding complaints that we submitted on reckless lending against numerous credit providers. And the 62 responses received are mainly consisting of just acknowledgements of the complaints or an accusation that we are acting outside of our mandate. So these complaints or these responses aren't even real responses regarding the actual complaint. More details on that can be provided if requested. I'm going to go into the detailed sections of the bill. I'm not going to touch on everything just because of time constraints. The first one being concerns regarding Section 82A, which is the suspension of reckless credit agreements by the National Credit Regulator. Now, the purpose behind this is probably to improve the enforcement of reckless credit, which is definitely important. We can't provide for reckless lending without providing proper enforcement mechanisms. But it is strange to me that an already failing NCR is given more authority instead of focusing on how do we actually provide real solutions to consumers, better access to these kind of remedies. As mentioned before, how does someone who lives in a rural area that doesn't have access to infrastructure, that can't necessarily read or write, gain access to the NCR? The suspension of reckless credit is also concerning because what can happen now is a debt counselor or credit provider is now compelled to address this issue. Firstly, a lot of debt counselors do not have the knowledge or the experience or the financial means to do this. And where in the debt review process will this suspension or this referral, take place? Secondly, if a consumer is no longer required to give their consent or acknowledge that they want reckless lending to go further, even if it's by advice from the debt counselor, it must be done nonetheless. The consumer can then have a scenario where his account has been suspended by the National Credit Regulator. It is then later heard by the tribunal and found to be non-reckless, and then any benefit derived from that suspension, which means no interest or fees could run, is then lifted, which means the credit provider can then raise the interest and fees backdated. So you have a consumer that hasn't been paying for, as our indication is, could take up to a year, for 12 months, didn't pay an account because the account was suspended, was found not reckless by the tribunal, and now it's going to be caught up with a lot of their arrears, interest and fees on the account now being back added, which is not a solution at all. My submission here is that we are trying to create remedies where actually what we're supposed to be looking at is the preventative measures of reckless lending. More should be done in order to prevent reckless loans from being granted. The minimum expenses norms table is definitely not useful in this regard. Even though the intention was that it will be used as a benchmark in exceptional circumstances, our experience has shown that credit providers use this as the basic income of a consumer. So it's not being used as a minimum, it's been used as an actual indication of living expenses. And according to the table, for example, a consumer who earns 5,000 Rand per month will be spending something about 1,000 Rand on living expenses per month. That's all a credit provider needs to take into account according to this table, 1,000 Rand. And that is shocking because I don't know if any of us here can really say that someone earning 5,000 Rand is only spending 1,000 Rand on food, transport, banking fees, children's education, clothing, essentials in life. So this table definitely needs amendments, and there needs to be better research done in terms of the effect of this table in the industry itself. Just reiterating what we said already regarding over-indebtedness being such an important part in our legislation, protection of consumers, we need to do more in order to ensure that we protect consumers from reckless loans being granted and ensure that we actually do proper enforcement in that regard as well. Then moving on to the debt intervention sections of the Act, Section 88A regarding the application for debt intervention. What we would just like to point out here, as of debt counselling, no mention is made of parties married in community of property. So does this Act going to supersede the provisions in terms of our matrimonial property law? How will that be approached? Because again, we are saying all these things, but in practice, this does not reflect. We have to give clarity on that as well. The Act then makes special mention of disabled persons, minor or woman-headed households, saying that they are included in this process, which is obviously a given, was not necessary to put this in, unless the intention was to give special consideration in those cases. Our submission is that if there should be special consideration in those cases, that must be spelled out. Will the restrictions in terms of who will qualify be lifted in those circumstances or not? So it's important that there be clarity on exactly how disabled persons, minors, and women-headed households will be dealt with. Then realizable assets is a bit unclear. Will it mean that a consumer that has multiple properties worth millions will not be prevented from applying for debt intervention? Would that be the intention? So more clarity is needed on that. And also we submit that there should be more discretion. Saying that 10,000 Rand, maximum of 10,000 Rand realizable assets, that's the value that you'll look at. We have a consumer that has maybe a bucky with 15,000 Rand will now be disqualified, even though in the circumstances of their case, they might actually be a good candidate for debt intervention. It's also unclear if the intention of this process was that a once-off process, so that it will be run from November 2017 up until a certain time until a lot of consumers have been cleared, or will be an ongoing process. And will Section 88, capital F, then come into play where the minister can then from time to time provide certain circumstances where debt intervention will come into play? If that be the case, that must also be clarified, that it's a once-off process and that it will be later revived, almost like the debt amnesty approach. And then again, as we iterated, it's accessibility. How is someone that that stays in a mine, mining town, that doesn't have access to infrastructure, doesn't have access to the email, to emails or internet, how will they access this this relief mechanism? Will the NCR be setting up offices all around the country, allowing consumers to approach them, give their information, help them fill out the forms? How will this be practically implemented in the society? Then the evaluation mechanism is also important. Currently, the way I'm reading the Act, or sorry, the bill, is that there are three qualifying criteria. If you earn less than 7,500 Rand, if your unsecured debt is less than 50,000, and if your realizable assets is below 10,000 Rand in those given circumstances, then you automatically qualify. There are no indications of over-indebtedness. Will that play a role? What things will the NCR consider when they make this determination to refer a case to the tribunal? There needs to be more clarity on when or exactly a consumer will qualify for debt intervention. The bill also does a strange thing where they try to add extra enforcement for reckless credit, unlawful agreements, and prohibited conduct by the use of a Section 55 compliance notice. And our submission is that's not the right way to approach it. For example, an agreement cannot be declared reckless by a compliance notice. It can prevent a credit provider from granting further reckless credit, can provide perhaps a refund to be issued, but a lot of these circumstances need an investigation to be conducted and the tribunal to review it. Prohibited conduct is another one. You can't, a lot often it requires investigation and an order to be made. A Section 55 compliance notice cannot declare an agreement to be reckless. All right, and then with regards to Section 88C, which is the orders that that the tribunal can make, again reiterating there needs to be clarity on exactly how reckless credit, prohibited conduct, and unlawful credit agreements will be approached, and then as well as this indication of a void agreement. So the tribunal can declare the agreement void, but as we already saw in the Constitutional Court, that does not necessarily mean the consumer will no longer need to repay the debt. Unjustified enrichment can still be used. So that does not put the consumer in a better position, especially for unsecured debt. So how are we going to be dealing with that as well? And extinguishment of debt needs to be clarified, exactly what that will mean. Will that mean the consumer is no longer responsible for that loan, no longer required to make any payments? Definitely need some more clarity on that. And the financial literacy program that the minister must introduce is also very important, and we welcome financial literacy. It's definitely an important factor in South Africa. But the question is, how will this be implemented? Where will it be implemented? Will it be accessible to all consumers, especially considering that this will become a requirement for rehabilitation? So it needs to be clear from the beginning. We need to have proper structures in place to make sure the financial literacy programs are rolled out and are feasible. And then, again, just the applications for rehabilitation. There is a bit of a discrepancy because it requires that a consumer must make payment arrangements with their credit providers, or there must be some agreement with the credit providers regarding payments. However, you can also apply for rehabilitation if your debt has been extinguished. So you won't be able to make a payment arrangement because your debt has been extinguished. So there's not this bit disjointed in terms of the requirements for rehabilitation and exactly when it will be applied. And then, of course, Section 88F, the future debt interventions, how will that be applied? Is it because the Section 88A to E is a once-off approach, so F will come in and provide it at an ad hoc basis as needed, as required. And then just regarding section, moving away from debt intervention, sorry that I'm talking really fast in terms of time, but section 157C regarding the offences relating to registration of various parties or people, concern is raised in terms of alternative dispute resolution agents, also if you're acting as...
While we do want you to be succinct, we don't want this at the expense of quality. Just slow down.
Thank you. I tend to get passionate.
I actually am waiting for members to make marks in the actual bill so it's going to be easier, you know, to pursue it later, because what you are saying is important.
Thank you. Excuse me. Regarding alternative dispute resolution agents, it's important that there be clarity on exactly what this function is and when this will come into play. At the moment, there's no clear process, there's no clear indication as to when a person acts as an ADR agent. There was a very good article written by Professor Walker regarding ADR, and she makes comments in the line that if a law clinic who has attorneys acting on clients' behalf try to investigate or try to act in as a go-between a consumer and a credit provider, that person is now acting as an ADR agent and will require registration. This is concerning and clarity needs to be given. We can't have a scenario where a daughter is arrested after she or is given a penalty because she's trying to assist her dad in, you know, of confronting or mediating between her, the dad and a credit provider. So clarity needs to be given. We've been getting a lot of pushback from the National Credit Regulator regarding attorneys who have been told that they're acting as ADR agents, they're unregistered, and therefore cannot refer reckless loans to the National Credit Regulator. And when we asked for clarity on this, none was provided, only threats that we will be the attorneys will be investigated. So it's concerning that an attorney will be restricted from acting in their client's best interest when it comes to credit unless they're registered as an ADR agent. That makes no sense. So clarity needs to be given on exactly when a person will be regarded as acting as an ADR agent and what those functions exactly will entail. And that is that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do like the way you have so clearly prepared these slides. It's going to make it a lot easier for us to work with. But I think the point is now, let's just check if Mr. Gardner wants to add anything before we ask the committee members if they'd like to engage.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think... It comes down again to the indebtedness of consumers and allowing those consumers to access justice for relief. We've written the National Credit Act in order to protect consumers from themselves and their own desperation, as well as for lenders to protect them from themselves and chasing the wallet wars, because if they give any room in the spare cash flow of consumers, they know their competitor will grab it. And as a result, if we don't have very clear, easily enforced law, we will always have the ambiguity requiring declaratory orders and very expensive court cases. Today, or 10 years ago, we found ourselves with African Bank taking market share as a result of bending these rules and being aggressive with regards to these rules. Today, it's alleged that Capitec is the new front runner in taking market share. They certainly are the biggest. I'm not quite sure about all the irregularities that is alleged. But if we don't protect those lenders from doing good, so if they have to stop at 50% debt-to-income ratio and not fear the next lender from stealing the remainder of that free cash flow or that wallet or available cash flow, they will stop then. They will stop at 50%. But if they fear the next lender is coming along and will grant reckless loans without being punished, they can't afford to do that. The last lender puts their first loan or second loan at risk. Good lenders are being punished. Good lenders are being punished by high-risk lenders that are not punished for reckless lending and are more aggressive on the collecting front and putting their good loans at risk. And that's why we have 10 million consumers with 37% of all credit accounts in arrears. So if we're not writing laws that a consumer can come off the street, walk into a magistrate and say, excuse me, my debt installments of my last lender or my total debt installments now exceeds 40% of my net income as a result of this loan, declare it reckless. If we can't do that, you don't access justice. This consumer is disempowered. We're writing first world laws for a third world country. Majority of those requiring access to this justice live in a third world part of our economy. They do not have access to justice. We've shown it. We've shown that complaints to the NCR is more of a hindrance. We would love to go direct to court instead. We cannot. We're disempowered by the National Credit Act, read section 164. So this whole setup is there to allow thriving, aggressive, more aggressive lenders, the more risky lenders, to thrive under these circumstances. Those good lenders are prevented from remaining good because there's too much pressure on them from in terms of the wallet wars or the next lender putting their debts at risk. So what they'll rather do is steal all your disposable income, capture it, and therefore, as a result, no other lender can come in and provide a debt installment. There's no more room. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No members, please raise your hands. Honourable Williams, Honourable Matash, Honourable Kacharia. I'm going to ask Buyani to come in last, as it were. All right.
Thank you, Chair. So I just want to welcome the presentation. From your presentation, you talked about things like which clauses you had problems with, but you didn't give us what you thought that clause should read like. So you asked questions like, have you explored the following, or more should be done around this line. So what I'd like from you, if possible, in writing by email to the secretary of this committee, is in the amendment bill that's before us now, if you could write, you know, you could actually say, instead of writing A, B, and C, we want you to, we would prefer E, F, and G. So we can actually see exactly what you're talking about and what you want. And then my last question, or the question is, if not the National Credit Regulator, then who do you think should be doing the job that they're supposed to do? Because are you just saying that there's problems with their administration, or are you saying the whole system is problematic? Because if the whole system is problematic, we really need to know that up front. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Mantosh.
Thank you, Chairperson. My apologies for arriving late. Chair, I was not there when the presenter started, but I just want to understand. Well, firstly, I want to concur with what Honourable Williams is saying, that instead of questions, they should give us advice on the amendments that they say we must apply to the bill. But I also want to know, if they say they are the only voice for the poor, what does that mean? Are they a non-profit making organization or what?
Thank you very much, Honourable Mantosh, Honourable Kacharia.
Is that better?
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for your presentation. I have a couple of comments and questions. In the first instance, it's clear to all of us, I think, that recourse credit needs to be addressed. And globally and locally, there have been time-honored efforts in multiple geographies to strike a balance between the provision of healthy credit and to ensure that this time-honored practice of credit, which dates back to biblical times and before, is protected and dealt with in an honest, decent, and proper way. It cuts both ways, and the protection needs to be there. Now, to echo some of my colleagues' questions, I think we need to understand from you if you have vested interest in this particular area, in this broad area, as a service provider, as a paid service provider, and in what capacity you act, because I think that's important so that we can understand from whence you come. I have also a concern when you talked about first world laws for third world countries, because the logical continuum of that particular line of argument results in problematic law and faulty law being enshrined. And we have to be if our laws are not first world, then we are in deep, deep trouble. I will not countenance a retreat into third world law. So I put that on the table. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Buyani.
Chairperson, thanks very much. Mine is a clarity-seeking question. I just wanted to check if the presenters can be able to elaborate more on the issues, the incapacity and the failures of the NCR, as she argued, and also what are the views and the reason to those failures. I also wanted to double check in terms of their membership, who they are representing, and in terms of demographic representation. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Buyani. I think one of the... I'm sorry, Honorable Kachalia.
I forgot to ask a couple of other things. One is, again, in line with my colleagues who've requested some written responses from you as to what you're particularly advocating, perhaps you could orally give us, in summary, the headline news of what of your advocacy in this particular area now. And also, perhaps we can hear from the National Credit Regulator, who is here, what the reason was for non-referral in that particular instance, because I think that's important. Thank you.
Before we seek responses, just a minute there. Hello? Just wait. Members, will you please come to the front to make space for the members of the public who are coming in to make an input? Yes, please. Let's do that very quickly, so that we can, and then will you take the space vacated, please? You can begin to move in, as it were. And just while this changeover is occurring, perhaps Summit Finance, you indicate, you know, never been invited before, etc., and you welcome the opportunity. Wait a minute. However, when any company or university or anyone may make a submission as soon as that's advertised, you see. So do take advantage of the general invitation per se, number one. The other issue, as the members were raising clarifications, comments and questions, I wondered, now Summit Finance, and you may have indicated this already, how are you funded? I did not get a clear understanding of that myself. Are you an NGO? If you are an NGO, how do you survive, per se? Thank you. Right, over to Summit Finance, Mr. Gardner, and your colleague. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. Madam Chair, just for clarification with regards to our being unheard, we have submitted each from 2004, the National Credit Acts or Bill at that stage, we've submitted in Parliament, but our submissions, my point was, has never been heard, has never been taken note of. And as a result, we sit with debt counselling issues that doesn't work. We have reckless lending that is very difficult to prove and enforce. We have this bill that will be unenforceable, so that is our point on that matter. Just as
a clarification from Mr. Herman's, 2004. Unfortunately, we will have to ascertain from those who were sitting here at the time as to what happened. Obviously, you take responsibility for what has occurred when you weren't here, but if you do not know what happened, it becomes a problem. But one would hope since 2009, anything you have submitted has been responded to, and you've been given a reason as to why we refuse to hear you, because I have never signed such a letter. Thank you.
Just to start off perhaps with a bigger picture, who is Summit and what are we about and how are we funded? It seems like that's a regular question and a very fair question. To start off with, Summit is a purpose-driven entity. Its purpose is to bring positive change to the financial services industry by doing great things for the consumers. That is what drives us. That is our primary motive. We are, however, not a not-for-profit organization. We do make profits. We are funded primarily via employers who pay us to look after the financial health of their employees. Using that and those funds, we then make use of or identify irregularities that take place financially from those individuals or employees that work for those employers. We have a big pool as well that don't work for the employers that we give assistance free of charge, predominantly coming from the Stellenbosch Law Clinic and so on, from their leads. You saw that in the Constitutional Court case with Flemix. We were a big party towards that, led by Wendy Applebaum. So there's no doubt we are profitable. It makes us sustainable, and in the words of Johann Rupert, in order to do good, you must do well. We take that mantra quite literally. In terms of the questions, first, Honourable Williams, we have made a submission in writing, initially, and there we have put details or exact suggestions on a lot of the bill's clauses. I think it touches in with Honourable Kachalia's point as well, or what we actually orally, what would we actually suggest? Again, if you learn by example, Section 106 of the National Credit Act with regard to credit life insurance, it would state it must be market-related. Now, the man on the street cannot enforce that my credit life insurance was exaggerated, was not market-related. Good luck. That will cost you 500,000 rand in court to get a declaratory on. You've got no chance of getting anywhere, winning anything with that kind of law written. That's the first world law that I'm referring to. It's not, it's ambiguous, it's difficult to prove, and it relies on a strong ombudsman, a strong regulator, to obtain declaratory using the courts, like we see in the UK. They are the ones at the forefront of the courts using market play as well as these ambiguous laws to create declaratory and then you have precedent. That's first world. In a third world where we don't have a strong regulator, that's not creating declaratory. In fact, we're in court in March, the biggest case this country has seen in this national, with regards to the National Credit Act, trying to prove the ultra in duprum rule on Section 101 and 103. Why? Because no one else has done it. In fact, there's opinions out there, both by the National Credit Regulator and many others, that is really resulting in 500 Rand debts being collected, total collections on that 11,500 Rand, because no one's bothered to take that piece of legislation and get a declaratory. So we're doing it. Again, another million or 2 million, and if we lose, a lot more. So that's in March against Stain Attorneys, and we look forward to the outcome of that. So that's what I meant. Let's write law that can be enforced that doesn't require declaratory by regulators or bodies like ourselves, because that is expensive and time-consuming and removes access to justice for the man on the street. With regards to Honourable Williams, is the system broke? What is happening? I think what I'm asking for is the regulator and the tribunal was brought about to ease the process of breaches to the Act and allows us not to pursue the expensive court case route as consumers or stakeholders or interested bodies. I want to emphasize that it will be much easier and less expensive for us to go direct to court. Only because we do not get any joy, as I showed you stats, I'm not lying, there's stats on the board, I've got further stats where we had another 4,000 complaints with regards to access to documents, etc., etc. I've got a high court judgment showing where Lewis Group raised an exception on our papers that we first need to get a National Consumer Tribunal certificate. So I cannot pursue the court route. I had to go back to the tribunal or I had to change my papers. That cost me 200,000 rand because I lost in court. And that's what we're trying to emphasize. You're removing access to justice in the man in the street. Rather say, credit life insurance cannot be more than 4.50 on the reduced balance. Please, that really has hurt society. Again, unheard. You are smiling, I see. Unheard. I've made big screams. It cannot be on the outstanding balance. You're paying 450 in your last installment and it's for credit life insurance. It makes no sense. So rather write it in very accurate, distinct terms. Reckless lending is if your unsecured debt installments, let's define unsecured credit, those that yield more than 20% per annum. Unsecured credit, if it exceeds 40% of your basic income, is reckless. A man on the street can approach the court and he can get that written off as reckless. Instead of 2.5 years later and $1 million for Tobajani, and if I lose, a lot more. That's what we're trying to emphasize. Don't remove access to justice for the man on the street. So the system is not broke. It should work, but it's not working. I think to unpack that, I don't have the reasons, but perhaps you will have better insights of why the law is not being enforced at a regulatory level. Honourable Mantashi asked, are we a non-profit? I've answered that question. Honourable Kacharlia, you asked about reckless credit. It needs to be addressed. You asked about healthy credit. What is healthy? I think that's another term. What is enforceable, I think, is the term that we've got to highlight. That's very important. 40%, I'd say 40% of net income in terms of total debt installments towards unsecured debt should be your cutoff. Easily, for right throughout all groups, people are going to give you studies and they're going to get big bucks on all these consultants to tell you why you can't just have a cutoff. But in the end of the day, everyone can enforce that. Everyone knows it. Everyone understands it. It can be enforced. Do I have a conflict of interest? I certainly do. I get paid by employers to look after employees' financial health. The easier that I can enforce the National Credit Act, the cheaper I can enforce the National Credit Act, the better I do, the more value I add. So there's no doubt. We are also registered debt counselors. We have a small, very small percentage of our clients under debt counseling. I have a conflict there. I am a registered ADR. So I have a conflict there, if there's any conflict. I'm also a shareholder in a company called Q-Link. There might be a conflict there, but I can assure you that I sit here trying to adhere to our purpose, which is to bring positive change to the financial services industry, and that we get exposed, I'll never forget, in 2003 when we started the business, on how an employee in Fitch Mine stole food stamps because he had 6 garnishee orders from African Bank. He then got caught stealing, got fired, and then committed suicide. Those are the situations we sit with. We get to see. The grant recipients that Marietta interviewed, where 750 Rand grant goes 150 Rand via unauthorized debit orders and a 300 Rand loan deduction. How do you live off the 200 Rand? Why is the law not protecting this person, or why is the law not being enforced? We'll try, but it's going to cost us 2 years and a few bucks to make that happen. I'm looking at other, in terms of the incapacity of the National Credit Regulator to elaborate. I suppose the best way to look at it is the scorecard. The scorecard is probably the financial health of the consumer. There's 10 million consumers who've missed installments or are in arrears. A vast majority of them have impaired records. The, as mentioned before, the group earning less than 7,500 Rand income per month took 0.21% of the mortgages advanced in the last quarter ending in September 2017. Those rand value of short-term credit for that group was 29%. So they're using short-term credit to live. Short-term credit, when you go in arrears with short-term or unsecured credit, then the nonsense really happens. Then you get arrears, penalty, interest, whatever is illegal is charged, and you end up with an emolument attachment order. Currently, we're in court with 1,300 emolument attachment orders that never went through to court. They're deducting off payroll. Fraud. So that's how they collect on this. And those debts were 1,000 Rand, and they're collecting 5, 6, 7,000 Rand on those via payroll deduction. No one's enforcing these. So in terms of the scorecard, I would watch that 10 million Rand very closely. The only time it's ever decreased is when you wrote law to write off credit bureau old records. So only improvement, any law has improved. And that is just, you know, that's window dressing. That's putting lipstick on a pig. In terms of our demographics, I'm not quite sure in terms of staff or clients. In terms of clients, vast majority of our client demographics are black or colored. Majority of our clients are mine workers, and we're doing quite a bit of work now on the grant recipients and trying to change that. In terms of staff, we are 70-80% non-white. I hope I've answered all those questions. I have that on my list. Maria, is there anything from your side?
Thank you. I would just quickly like to add something regarding the first world and the third world comments. And the idea is not so much that we shouldn't strive towards effective and efficient first world type of laws. The problem here comes more in terms of the average South African consumer and who they are and understanding them better and making sure we don't write laws that are theoretical, but they are practical. So, for example, the pre-agreement quotation that came in with the National Credit Act back in 2005, that was a great idea that consumers will use this opportunity to shop around, but that is not the average South African consumer. The average South African consumer will sign any document placed in front of them, will not understand the terms and conditions of that document. The introduction of the credit cost multiple with the last amendment was another oversight. That means nothing to the average South African consumer. I didn't even understand what that meant. I had to go read up. I had to go find the act. So this idea that we can create laws because theoretically it makes sense to us does not resonate practically always. And Summit, we do great work in terms of working with consumers. I see it every day where the law and the practice does not mesh. I come from the University of Pretoria Law Clinic where we did a lot of work with over-indebtedness in South Africa and working with the National Credit Regulator and addressing a lot of these issues and with Franz Hub there as well. They did great work and they did a great report on garnishee orders as well. And we see it all the time. And it is about creating access to justice for consumers, real justice for consumers. And we need to approach it differently. We need to see it differently and we need to find out exactly what's going on at ground level. Thank you.
Ms. Grace, there's just one thing I would like perhaps clarified. Throughout your comments here, you've emphasized the need for more efficient, more effective enforcement, more so than saying this law is wrong, per se. It's been a question, as I understand it, this is not going to achieve this because of X and Y and Z. It's not strong enough. You need better enforcement. On the other hand, with this enforcement, etc., you know, one has a situation which you've commented on here about over-indebtedness and the 39% impaired, etc., etc. Would you agree that some of the preventative measures would be, as mentioned or noted somewhere in the bill, the need for financial literacy on the one hand, but also, as one begins to hear, trying to make the law more accessible to ordinary people. Now, that has been a principle and a goal of the government since it came in. And you're saying that we haven't really achieved this with the current proposed bill, or it is not achieved even in the Act, the National Credit Act. I just want that clarity, because I hear you being very clear. No, you know, we're not saying first world or third world. It's something deeper than that. Just clarify that for me, Mr. Gardner.
Thank you. Yes, spot on. It is a combination of better enforcement and easier enforceable laws. So those are certainly a combination requirement. I disagree strongly on the need for financial literacy as a prevention, as a preventative. The reason being is that financial health or financial discipline is a behavioral aspect. Yes, the awareness and financial literacy will certainly assist. It creates awareness on the dangers of borrowing, on costs, and why you shouldn't sign up for compulsory delivery fees. That's all great, but it's going to take a long time to reach everyone with not a great success rate. You're dealing with 10-15% success rate because we have to teach our consumers in terms of behavior, impulse control, discipline. Those are very different requirements to financial literacy training. Everyone, or almost everyone, knows they must spend less than they must than they earn. That is the primary principle behind financial literacy. Can they adhere to that? No, and they are their worst enemies. I'm not saying that the borrowers are completely not to blame here. They are definitely to blame. However, we've got to stop where we can get 100% success rate is by controlling the provider. It's like the drug dealer and the drug addict. The drug addict's not going to stop. We've got to cut off the supply. We've got to regulate the supply to protect the consumer from themselves. So that is why I would say financial literacy is not your silver spoon or your piece of magic. Maria, do you want to add on to that?
We must thank you. Oh, hang on. Honourable Williams wanted to follow up, and Honourable Mantash, my apologies.
Thank you. Sorry, you said that you had submitted the clauses you wanted amendment, but in the document that I've got, which is this one, it's very unclear what exactly you want. So can you please send us another one that's got the clause and then your clause in full written out so we can see where it fits in? Thank you.
Williams, Honourable Mantash.
I'm covered by Honourable Williams, Chairperson, but I just want to contest the space where they say they are the only voice of the poor. I think the ANC is.
Yes, we all gonna, you know, lay claim to that, right? But I haven't heard anyone who doesn't lay claim to that, frankly. But thank you very much for emphasising that, Honourable Mantash. Thank you to Summit Finance, and we move on there to the Consumer Goods Council of South Africa, and the Consumer Goods Council will be led by Ms. Pillay, is that right? And Ms. Claire Morrissey. Right. We did say this yesterday, that all those sharing information, making submissions and coming here, we may in fact call on any one of you again or ask for further information, because the goal is the development of robust legislation. I think we would all agree on that. Thank you. Okay. You're going to take the lead here. We're not aware of your position.
Thank you, Madam Chair and honourable members. I represent Consumer Goods Council of South Africa, looking after stakeholder engagement in the Legal and Regulatory Affairs Division. And perhaps it's a good point to start with sharing what exactly Consumer Goods Council does. The name can be slightly misleading.
But we all members of trade and industry, I'm the chair. There's a difference. Exactly what position do you occupy?
Sure. Executive stakeholder engagement and legal and regulatory affairs. Thank you. So the Consumer Goods Council, as I've said, the name is slightly misleading. We're actually not a consumer body. We are, however, an organization that is created by the industry. It's a not-for-profit organization, and we are funded by the members being the retailers and manufacturers. Predominantly in the consumer, the fast-moving consumer goods space. In April 2010, however, the Furniture Traders Association merged with the Consumer Goods Council. So that extended our scope to the furniture traders as well. So we currently have 35 small furniture retailers. So this can be your one-man, two-man stores around the country. And then we have your larger furniture traders, which are the Lewis Group, ShopRite, and the JD Group. So as much as, yes, we represent business, our ultimate industry and objective as an industry is to ultimately protect the consumer in all that we do. So in terms of our submissions, we have put in extensive submissions, but in our slides, we've just highlighted our key areas. My colleague, Claire Morrissey, will be taking us through that today. And we've also put in recommendations. So if it's not coming out very clear in this presentation, we can just highlight those that we have put in wording and recommendation. So I can hand over to my colleague.
Morrissey. Thank you, Madam Chair, honourable members. Thank you for this opportunity to just highlight some of the key provisions that we have set out in our more comprehensive submissions that we submitted in writing to you. Our first point is almost more of a question, and that is that it relates to the fact that the bill was coming had been very well publicised for over a year or so before it was actually published in November last year. And as part of those publications, the market was led to believe that a full socio-economic impact assessment study would be conducted. And that gave the market some comfort that whatever was coming was going to be well backed up and that there wouldn't be a lot of scary potential negative consequences that could flow from the well-meaning intentions of the bill. And we noted in the press in about October last year, so just a few months ago, that the South African Reserve Bank as well called for a quantitative impact assessment study to be conducted and was at pains to emphasize how important financial stability was to, as part and parcel of putting this bill together. Now, I might be in the dark, and forgive me if I am, but I'm just not aware of whether or not those impact assessment studies have indeed been carried out, and if they have, if they've been made available to the public. And if in fact they have not been, then we submit that this bill is premature and it shouldn't be finalized until such time as those impact assessment studies have been done. Because although the intentions of the bill are very noble and we agree that there is a large society in this country that is over-indebted and should be assisted, we are concerned that what's currently presented in this bill is actually going to bring about a series of very negative effects and actually end up being to the detriment of the consumer, which goes against the very purpose of what it's setting out to do. So our first submission really is, please, we have to have that impact assessment done. We need to see it as the public. It's absolutely essential that we understand what the impact of this bill is going to be on consumers, on the credit markets, on job losses and creations in the country, etc. So some of the negative effects of the bill that we fear, potential negative effects, relate to the fact that not only does it put large parts of credit providers' current debtor books at risk due to the proposed debt intervention measures, But there's also this low-hanging cloud of potential future risk as a result of the minister's new powers to introduce new debt intervention measures from time to time. It just creates great uncertainty. It increases the risk from the lender's perspective. And so the lender retaliates. The lender puts up fences to protect itself as a result of this increased risk. It makes it harder to apply for credit. It makes the affordability system more stringent. It, going forward, will more than likely regard these this category of consumer that earns less than 7,500 Rand a month as a high-risk consumer, contrasted with the current position where that category of consumer constitutes almost half in number of the unsecured credit market, 48%. It will impose higher interest rates, impose stricter lending conditions, and in effect, it will just put up a barrier to this section of the market to enter the credit market altogether. It will make it harder and it will make it more expensive to borrow. We're not saying it will, but we fear that it will, if in the absence of an impact assessment study being conducted. And if that is the case, then we submit that this just goes against a number of the purposes that are currently set out as being the goals of the National Credit Act. They set out in Section 3, and it's not just one of the stated goals. There are a number of goals set out there that we think this bill flies against, and I've picked out just a few to emphasize the point. The one being that the National Credit Act is intended to promote an accessible credit market, and it's particularly to those consumers who historically have been denied access to credit. We read that in to be some of the poorest of the poor, earning less than 7,500 Rand a month. The Act is also intended to promote responsible borrowing and fulfillment of financial obligations. Obviously, a debt relief measure that writes out debt goes against that stated purpose. Addressing over-indebtedness based on the principle of satisfaction by the consumer of all financial obligations. I'm not writing this language. This is coming straight out of the existing National Credit Act. And lastly, just to drive it home, to promote a consistent system of debt restructuring which places priority on the eventual satisfaction of all responsible consumer financial obligations. So I'm not talking about the reckless credit here. If credit has been advanced recklessly to a consumer, totally wrong. Consumers should be off the hook completely with no bad implication for its credit record or anything like
Morrissey,
that.
Morrissey, Mr. Hermans tells me people are finding it difficult to hear you at the back. You could perhaps try talking into the mic, but not like that, all right?
We are also concerned about the macroeconomic effects of the bill. If lenders are compelled to write off large proportions of their debtor books, basically upon the direction of the minister from time to time, what is that going to mean for investor confidence in this country and the stability of the credit market? I understand this concern has been raised already by a number of presenters yesterday, but one of our other major concerns relate to the cost and capacity implications of this bill. Just to publicize the measures that this bill seeks to introduce is going to take a massive marketing initiative to get through to all the consumers on the streets as to whether you qualify for the debt intervention, how you go about applying, et cetera, et cetera. That will require an enormous marketing budget. And also, all the additional new responsibilities and duties that are placed on the NCR to handle the reckless lending complaints, to assess and refer the debt intervention processes will require enormous increased capacity at the NCR. And they already stretched the seams. They already have backlogs. Where is that capacity going to come from, and how is it going to be funded? Neither the bill nor the memo on the objects of the bill deal with that, although it does say in the memo that we anticipate that it will be a short-term capacity requirement, which also in and of itself raises issues as how you fill that capacity on a short-term basis. But I'm not entirely sure that it is short-term, given the potential for future debt relief and intervention measures to be introduced in the future. And over and above the capacity and increased cost for the NCR itself, the obviously increased cost across the market as well. Credit bureaus will have increased costs with their increased responsibilities and reporting duties, and obviously credit providers' costs will also increase, having to deal with these new processes contemplated in this bill. And what
tends to happen when there are all these increased levels of increased costs is that ultimately it's the consumer who picks them up at the bottom. And so again, this is a concern that we have that in the medium to long term, although there might be a short-term benefit of wiping out somebody's debt, in the medium to long term, the effects are going to be negative for the consumer. One of the eligibility requirements that the bill sets out for a consumer who wishes to apply for this relief is that they need to earn less than 7,500 Rand per month. And we object to this threshold as being too high. Our reasons for saying so are because the bill is intended to assist the indigent. If we look at the unsecured credit numbers over the last 5 years, which we've obtained from the NCR's own quarterly reports that they issue every quarter, we see that there are 46.1 million unsecured transactions with consumers earning less than 7,500 Rand. And that equates to the 48% that I mentioned earlier. Essentially, it's almost half of the unsecured market, not in value but in number of transactions. And we just struggle to believe that half of the unsecured market can be regarded as indigent and in need of the relief contemplated in this bill. And so we urge you to look at this 7,500 Rand threshold again, and just to, and also in the context of having an impact assessment study, to verify whether that number is right and whether it shouldn't, rather in the context of our society in South Africa, be a lesser number. We are also concerned that the 50,000 Rand upper threshold, in other words, in order to be able to apply for this relief, you need to have less than 50,000 Rand of unsecured debt in total. We are concerned that that threshold is also too high. In other words, we cast in the net too wide such that too many consumers can apply for this relief. And again, our reason for saying so is based on numbers that we've taken out of the NCR's quarterly reports. We've set it out in more detail in our written submissions, but by way of summary, the table up on the screen there shows, if we focus in on the bottom line of the table, it shows the total unsecured debt in South Africa as of 31 December 2016 being 389 billion rand. And that large number is comprised of 32.4 individual unsecured transaction agreements with an average value per agreement of, call it 12,000 rand. So just looking at that number, 12,000 rand, immediately there's a sense that the 50,000 rand is too low. But again, obviously the first answer back to that is, well, very few consumers will only, in this category, who need help, will have only one unsecured loan. Right. So for purposes of example only, in the last column of the table, we've taken, that second to last number is wrong. It shouldn't be 40,000. The 27 should have carried across. Apologies for that error. But if we assume for now that a consumer has every type of unsecured credit agreement that is reported on in this country, in other words, down the left column, a credit facility, an unsecured loan, and a short-term debt, on average, the total aggregate debt for a consumer who has all of those would be 40,000 Rand, still way below that 50,000 Rand cap. So it's for these, and there are a number of examples you can throw around, but that's just to taste it, to give you a sense that 50,000 Rand may well be too high, and that we're just opening the door for too many consumers. Because if too much of that 389 billion rand is written off pursuant to this process, it's going to have drastic consequences for the credit providers and for the credit economy in this country. So the bill, in ascertaining whether a person qualifies for applying for this debt relief, takes into account the consumer's income and their realizable assets. And that realizable assets is a complex criterion, and we do take issue with that as well in our submissions, but I'm not going to harp on that today. Safe to say that we think additional eligibility criteria are needed to make sure that this net is appropriate, that we really are helping the people who really need this kind of intervention. So in addition to looking at their income, we think the consumer's expenses and debts have to be taken into account. The consumer must show, just to enter this application process, that they are, in fact, over-indebted. This relief shouldn't be available to a consumer who may well earn less than 7,500 Rand a month, but who is very ably managing their financial affairs. we submit that an eligibility criterion should be show that you are over-indebted first. In addition, we think this relief should only be available to what we've termed vulnerable consumers. It's also a term that's referred to in the memorandum to the bill but doesn't follow through into the drafting of the bill. What the bill could define what is meant by a vulnerable consumer, but what we have in mind here would be, for example, a person who loses their work as a result of downscaling or retrenchment or redundancy and who doesn't have credit life insurance in place. That person is a vulnerable consumer and should be assisted, and this relief should be available to them. It shouldn't be available to the so-called bad lever, the person who loses their job because they committed fraud or stole. In our view, that's taking it too far. We also think that the consumer should have paid at least something towards their debt. It shouldn't just be a get-out-of-jail-free, even if you haven't paid a cent towards what you were validly granted. So again, I'm not talking about the consumer who's been granted credit recklessly and they should never have got it in the first place. I'm talking about the consumer who could afford it at the time of granting it, made some payments towards it, and then something happened in their life that stopped them, changed their financial situation so that they couldn't continue paying. Again, something to make sure that you can that you're eligible to apply should be that you've paid some sort of reasonable proportion, which the bill should set out what that reasonableness is. We also think that then the consumer should have an impaired record. The memo to the objects of the bill is quite clear as to what's impaired. That means at least 3 months of being unable to meet your installments. If you tick all of those boxes, then from our perspective, we say, yes, you are deserving of this relief. Please can we help you and write your debt off. Over and above the eligibility criteria for whether you can or cannot apply for the debt intervention, the bill is a little bit unclear as to what circumstances need to be proven by the consumer that will enable the NCT to actually grant the debt intervention. So they've got through the door, they're eligible to apply, but what does the NCT look at to say, yes, this consumer should be granted the debt intervention measures? Because the bill sets out a number of options available to the NCR when it's making its recommendation to the NCT, and for the NCT when it's determining finally what relief should be granted. For example, if the consumer is having difficulty in satisfying his or her debts, that consumer may be referred to debt review. But if debt review won't be effective, then the debt relief measures are available to the NCT. But that's all it says. So it doesn't make it clear to the market, to the consumer, to the credit provider, when it's appropriate for the debt relief to be granted. And aside from the factors that I went through on the previous slide, I'm not entirely sure what that should be. Perhaps if you meet all those entry-level requirements that we went through just now, that is sufficient to show that you are eligible to receive the relief, but the bill doesn't deal with that currently, and we say that it should. In essence, we also think that there are better ways to achieve the ends that this bill is seeking to address. If the mischief to be addressed is to assist consumers who are over-indebted as a result of being granted reckless credit, then we say, hang on, the Act already sets out remedies that can solve that if it's properly enforced and efficiently operated at the NCR level. There's already Section 83 in the bill which allows the entire debt to be written off with absolutely no negative consequences for the consumer, no negative effect on their credit bureau profile, whereas, you know, contrasted with the debt intervention measures, they're going to have a negative stamp against their name. They'll be prevented from borrowing for another 3 years potentially. So this is not the relief for a reckless lending situation. Debt review and loan consolidation remain effective ways to manage over-indebtedness. And importantly, through these existing processes, there's an education element that flows through for the consumer. Through sitting across the table with the debt counselor, the consumer is taught how to budget, how to manage their payments, how to correspond and liaise with the credit provider. It's such an important process, and we submit that that process is far more beneficial for the consumer long-term than a once-off write-off that clears their debt today, and in a few years' time when they're allowed to borrow again, they get right back into that cycle of debt. The memo on the objects of the bill identifies the key problem in regard to debt review as being that it's unaffordable for this category of consumer. That comes through loud and clear. So if that's the main problem, we say let's address that problem. We don't need to create a whole new system that's very complicated and difficult to understand and will take another 10 years before we're all on top of it, just like we did with the NCA. We're still not on top of all of it. And create a whole new host of problems when we can zone in on this very defined crystal problem. There's a section of consumers that cannot afford debt review. So let's refine the existing debt review process. Let's incentivize the debt counselors to take on these type of consumers. And that's obviously it's going to require some form of subsidization from government, perhaps cross subsidization from industry as well. From the industry perspective, it's a whole lot better to cross-subsidize the debt review process than to write off great giant swathes of debt from their debtor's book. Another more technical objection that we have to the way that the bill is currently drafted is that it appears that this debt intervention application process is all brought on an ex parte basis by the NCR, and there's no opportunity for credit providers who may be opposing the process to also put papers before the NCT and to make sure that their side of the story is also heard. It's a basic audi alteram partem part of our law. We think it's missing here. We understand that there's an efficiency that we're wanting to achieve here, that the solution needs to be found quickly. They can't wait another 1 or 2 or 3 or 6 months before their problem's solved. But there also needs to be a way to let the credit providers in so that if, for example, there's a credit provider who's wrongly included in the net because they're a secured creditor, not unsecured, they can put papers, they can appear before that NCT member who's hearing the matter and say, there's a problem here. It's simply just not fair to be able to rely solely on what the NCR puts in those papers based on what the consumer has told the NCR. There needs to be two sides to the story. There is a section in the bill that allows a credit provider to set the matter down for reconsideration. Those are the words used. So there is an opportunity there, but we don't know what that means. It's a bit short on detail. Is that a right of appeal? If it is a right of appeal, how does it work if the credit provider wasn't involved in the application process up to that point? Who hears the matter? Is it the same member of the NCT that heard the original application, or is it escalated to another member or to a full bench of the NCT, or is it heard by another court? These are quite technical things, but we submit that they need to be addressed in the bill so that it's clear. Because if the credit provider is going to be omitted from the process, there does need to be a clear opportunity at the end of the process, if they're not going to be involved, which we think is still first prize, for remedies to be available to the credit provider. One of the big changes introduced by the bill is the increased powers granted to the NCR to suspend credit agreements that it regards, based on the information that it's obtained, to be reckless. And as a matter of legal principle, we object to this. We believe that that is an adjudicatory power that rightly sits with a tribunal or a court such as the NCT. It shouldn't be available to the NCR to grant one of the remedies that currently, in terms of the Act, is only available after a credit agreement has been declared reckless. It just has devastating, well, it has very dire consequences for the credit providers concerned. These matters aren't going to be solved quickly. They're going to take 6 months, 12 months, maybe longer. To not be entitled to receive payments under those credit agreements, not be entitled to receive interest or fees and charges, is going to have a very detrimental effect, especially if it turns out that the NCT rules against the view that taken by the NCR. Here again, the solution lies in the correct enforcement of the existing provisions of the Act. There are remedies in there for reckless credit agreements. We need to work on ways to make them more effective, make sure that the NCR has sufficient staff to efficiently deal with the complaints and tackle the credit providers who are doing this wrongly head on. The NCR is not to be the judge in these matters. The NCR is tasked with monitoring, investigating, educating, issuing compliance notices. They are not the people who hand down the penalties for doing something wrong. The bill also introduces a new obligation on credit providers to essentially whistleblow, to report credit agreements that it believes are reckless that other credit providers have advanced. And there are certain philosophical reasons out there as to why that's not a good idea. But leaving those aside, just practically speaking, it's impossible. When a credit provider assesses affordability for a consumer who's applying for credit, they look at the financial position of the consumer at that point in time. And typically the credit providers use automated programmed systems. And those programs are not programmed to reasonably suspect. They look at the financial information put before them at that point in time. If another credit provider granted credit to that same consumer 6 months earlier, the financial information of that consumer is not before the credit provider today. It's just impractical and unworkable for credit providers to be policing their competitors and their co-credit providers out there. And it doesn't make sense to impose a new obligation on them in this act with severe consequences for failing to comply of administrative fines, etc., if practically speaking, it's not workable. While talking about practicalities, just in relation to the debt intervention application processes, there is a line in the sand of 24 November 2017 when the consumers get assessed. That is one marker. But on the other side of that, it's open-ended. The bill doesn't set out any limitation as to when the application needs to be brought. And all we submit in here is the bill should set out a reasonable time period within which consumers have to bring their applications for debt relief. We submit that 6 months would be reasonable, whether it's 6 months or 12 months, whatever it is that you think is a reasonable time period, it should be stipulated. Likewise, the time period that the NCR has to evaluate the application and to make a recommendation to the NCT should also be stipulated in the bill as having a reasonable period. Again, we suggest 3 months as being reasonable to keep the process moving. Sorry. Of concern to us is the provision in the new bill that gives the minister the new power to introduce further debt intervention measures from time to time. There are certain parameters set out in the bill, which do make sense, but there is still the ability for the minister to step outside of those parameters and to nevertheless introduce what we consider to be fairly drastic measures because they include writing off debt completely. If the minister is going to have this power, we ask that section that allows the minister to step out is not included. He has to act within the parameters that are clearly set out in the bill. We also think that the power is just a little bit too broad. It needs to be fettered a bit. And key here is that there should be an obligation placed on the minister to first conduct an impact assessment study before introducing any such measures. Like the way that we're arguing for this very relief now, but do the impact assessment study, have a good sense of what the likely effects of the relief are going to be. What impact are they going to have on the industry? Are there going to be job losses? Is it actually going to increase the cost of borrowing for consumers? And then lastly on this point, the bill provides for a 30-day period in which to comment, and we just ask that this is not a simple area of law, and it is meaningful to a lot of people. We would say that a longer period, something like 60 to 90 days, would be more reasonable, especially if the draft proposal is published in a traditionally very busy retail period or a holiday period. Turning now to the mandatory credit life insurance provisions, we don't think that we object to making it mandatory, but we do take some objection to the language used in the section because it speaks of the credit provider and the consumer concluding the credit insurance life policy. And obviously, as the credit provider, they're not the insurer. They don't conclude the contract. So there's just some tightening on the language that's required there. Rather, the bill should say that it's a prerequisite or a condition to concluding the credit agreement, that credit life insurance is in place. And very importantly, the credit provider cannot oblige the consumer to take out that credit life insurance from a particular insurer. So the consumer might have that credit life insurance in place on the date when the credit agreement is concluded, but the next day or the next month cancel that credit life insurance, and that protection will no longer be in place. And we ask that the bill makes it clear that in those circumstances the credit provider wouldn't be in the wrong, because there's certain things beyond its control. It can state clearly as a condition in its deal that that credit life insurance policy must remain in place. But if it doesn't, because the consumer terminates it or ceases to pay the premiums, that shouldn't be placed at the blame of the credit provider. Also, just as a general observation, we would strongly urge that any of these sections that deal with insurance, credit life insurance, does need to involve the FSB. As the lead insurance regulator in the country, they may well have had input, but we plead that if they haven't, that they do have sight of these provisions and have an opportunity to comment. We also note that the bill obliges the minister, so not just empowers, but obliges the minister to publish further credit life insurance regulations that limit the premiums that may be charged for this type of mandatory credit life insurance. And that does cause some fear amongst all the credit providers for all the reasons that enunciated earlier. In August last year, the new credit life insurance regulations were promulgated and came into effect after a very long process of public participation. Everyone's still getting their heads around them, and they drastically changed the way that credit insurance policies are priced. And there is deep concern that something more is now contemplated here. And industry asks, what more? Do you mean you're going to further limit, over and above those limitations already in the new regs, in terms of this provision? Then my very last point goes to the long list of new offences that have been, criminal offences that have been included in the bill. We submit that this has taken a giant step backwards and not in line with best international practice. Over the last decade or so, the South African legislature has been at pains to decriminalise statutory non-compliance in business legislation. So in the Companies Act, in the National Credit Act, and the Consumer Protection Act, if you look in those acts, there are very few. There's a handful of criminal offences, and that was purposely done in favour of more effective regulation. So in the context of the NCA, the NCR was established, the NCT was established, and they were given tools to more ably inspire compliance with the Act. And we say those existing remedies and tools are more than sufficient. The ability to give compliance notices, administrative fines of up to 10% of turnover, that's a very effective tool. The ability to suspend or cancel a license to be a credit provider and having to repay to consumers, etc. Introducing all these new offences requires effective enforcement. So that's going to put new additional strain on an already overburdened NPA and the criminal justice court system. It will have a higher burden of proof beyond all reasonable doubt instead of a balance of probabilities. And it's very expensive and time-consuming to prosecute those matters. And people are going to prosecute those matters and litigate to the end. They're not going to settle halfway because the consequences are too dire. And in effect, it's going to end up choking up the system, which will be to the detriment of the economy and ultimately to the consumer. So as a last plea, we ask that we reconsider the inclusion of all these new offences. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to both of you, in fact, but Ms. Morrissey, right. We'll now offer the committee an opportunity to engage. Honourable Williams, right. Honourable Eersterhuizen, right. Shall we leaving it there for the moment?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that your input, you started off by threatening this committee that if we did go through with this legislation, that interest rates would be increased and there'd be less access to credit for the vulnerable, who are still mostly black people in South Africa. And I think that this attitude is completely unacceptable, and I don't think that threatening us with such things is the way forward to move us into your way of thinking.
I'd also like to just ask, was Ella Reins a member of your council, and what actions is your council taking currently to prevent such a the Ella Reins, situation happening again in some of your members? But I'm a little bit disappointed with the way in which you came at us with these sort of, if you do this, then we as a sector will respond this way. And I think that isn't helping. We have a massive over-indebted black population, which is mainly black because of the disparities that were inherited from apartheid and are still in place today. And I think that having an attitude like this to say, well, if you try and alleviate their suffering, then what we'll do is we'll just make it impossible for them to borrow money. And I think that this attitude has also come from other people, Chairperson, and I don't think that this is helping us at all. And quite frankly, I'm very disappointed with your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Esterhazen, followed by the Honourable Kachalia. Do I see another hand? Honourable Montash. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. And I agree with most. I think there was the... although I say, and I said it yesterday as well, that unrealistic debt repayment still makes the poor to subsidize the rich. But there's so many faults and short-sightedness in this
just
bill.
A minute, Honourable Esterhazen, your mic.
Sorry.
Well, whose mic is it? Right, you're sharing.
Here's
right.
Your one. Sure. And it could have a very big impact on the industry. And I'm just going to run through a few notes, Madam Chair. The 7,500 Rand earnings that was set, also, I can't agree to that. Section 88F2 refers to widespread job losses, but 88F36 say that people qualifying earning less than 7,500 Rand. So which is which? Where does this go? Unemployed income or people employed but earning that? I agree what you say. I also, made another note. The cost of debt review, better ways to achieve the end on your page. The maximum interest that can be charged for debt consolidation on loans is 27.75%. You know, it's just unaffordable. It's passing the buck from the one to the other. And if you have a bad credit record, you've got no muscle to negotiate a better deal. So in most cases, instead of eliminating debt, it's moving it around. It's not debt consolidation, but rather debt displacement, I'll call it. The power to spend reckless credit agreements, powers of the NCR, the National Credit Regulator, the orders set out in 88C are too wide. For example, that the powers not exceeding 12 months, and then a further 12 months period for suspension period, 2 years, this will have a very negative effect on the financial institutions and people, and then just make it more expensive for people to borrow money. The minister's power is too broad. This should be limited to consumers who have lost their job, unemployed for a long period, and again, this can have very negative effects on financial institutions if the minister has this unlimited powers and making it more difficult. And it seems that very little thought has been put into the long-term effects on the impact of the economy, my opinion on this. New offences step backwards. Of course, imprisonment not exceeding 10 years and things like that. It's ridiculous. It's not practical and not desirable. I don't know where that comes from. Well, that comes to the end of it. Thank you, Minister.
Just be careful that you don't fade out towards the end. All right, we need to hear you're making some important comments. Right, Honourable Kachalia, followed by the Honourable Mantashe.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was not going to make any comments. I'd rather hope that the committee was going to take advantage of a very well-structured and informative presentation and to take on board many of the suggestions which are properly researched, in my opinion, and were delivered very eloquently. I was moved to actually enter this discussion a wee bit late as a result of the Honourable Williams' comments, which I find a little bit odd because I discerned no threat from the presenters. What I discerned was the flagging of certain unintended consequences from the market. And those are not threats. Those are realities which this committee, in drafting a bill which will deal with people's lives, with the livelihoods of those very people and their aspirations, which are met by the credit industry, needs to be taken into consideration. I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Honourable Kachalia, Honourable Mantashe.
No, Chairperson, thank you. I think, Chairperson, I have some concerns which I think they need to be addressed. I am not sure if the presenter is competing with the NCR in their day-to-day work, because throughout their presentation, they always refer to them as they've been given, if I get them very well, they've been given too much power. The minister's power is too much. It must not be extended. And the task of this committee and government is to protect the vulnerable. So I don't understand what you want us to do. Because if you broaden the scope of the minister's role, we want him to protect the vulnerable from the hyenas who sometimes are the credit the lenders. So what do you expect from us? And why are you behaving as if you are competing with the NCR? You're not competing with them. We want to give them power to protect the vulnerable people. And if I'm not comfortable with your assertion. That NCR is the arm of government, is our entity. So they have a duty to protect the vulnerable. Each time you speak like too much power is given to them. We want to give them more power, really. That's as far as I want to go.
Thank you, Honourable Mantashe. Thank you very much. That was everyone who had a hand up. So I think we need the responses from Ms. Pillay and Ms. Morrissey now. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Honourable Members. So Honourable Kachalia has really responded to Honourable Williams' assertion that it was a threat, and just to assert that by no means was it a threat. What we were doing was really trying to highlight the practicalities of enforcing the bill in its current format. And it's not a threat by any means, but it's the reality that we face as credit providers. And I think that we should be then granted that opportunity to present that, but also be proactive in putting forward solutions, which we have done in our submission. And so we're trying to be constructive in terms of this input. With regards to the comment and in terms of Ellerines, yes, Ellerines was a member at the time. As a council, we are a voluntary body. We're not a regulatory body. In terms of our codes of conduct, they're very broad in the sense that it's a very, very strong process in terms of terminating. Members can voluntarily resign. So once again, we're not a regulatory body to take action. But what we do, and I think that I think progressing in that area is we share best practices, we circulate the updates on the information and the gazettes, and we try and influence and assert that our members conduct themselves in a proper way. I think that you know, in terms of the sentiments of the national NCR, you know, I just want to say, Honorable Montashi, that that was not the intention in terms of our presentation. And if you reflect on what Ms. Morrissey has presented, she actually had empathy for the regulator, and she actually said that they need to increase their capacity. So by no means are we in competition with them. She also mentioned their backlog. So it was more of a case of understanding the critical role that they play and to say that they should continue playing that role and that we would support them, but we have to acknowledge that there are enforcement issues. So it's not that we want to take their role at all, and we understand that they play an extremely critical role. So I think that's my comment. And then, Clay, would you, do you want to have anything else?
Thank you. Just to respond to the first comment about coming across threateningly, for which I apologize if I did. That was not the intention at all. It's not intended to be a threat at all. In fact, what I was trying to do, rather unsuccessfully, was just explain a concern that we have, particularly in the absence of having an impact assessment study that gives comfort to the market that the relief that's contemplated in this bill will be rolled out in the manner that we all wanted to and not have these unintended consequences that we're concerned about. We're not for a moment saying, if you do this, this is going to happen, and we're going to do this. So, again, I apologize if it came across threateningly. It was more just to raise concerns.
All right. Yeah, it's always
you
well...
You all know what I mean.
Oh, gosh, Freud would be calling this a Freudian slip. But look, you know, I think sometimes a lot of tension comes in and it's a good idea to laugh. Right. But, you know, are you still on the floor then? Yes, you see, that's what helps me when I see the mic switched off that you have completed. Was the issue around anarenes, which was raised by a member, because the points that you appear to have made here, I hope I'm correct, is that the current issues, this bill, and in fact the Act itself needs to be enforced rather than a new bill created, and that three of the issues you highlight in the Act, which the bill should have addressed more effectively, was reckless lending and enforcement and that kind of thing. But having said that, when one has members, just as, you know, we've got members here in the trade and industry, I would be